You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
And this is Eddie Johnson's story. The story of a boy who had his heart set on being treasurer of his club. Of course, there wasn't any real reason for Eddie to be elected, but like most of us, he just hoped.
Welcome to episode 207 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Liebenow, and thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by Alexander Robinson from Alexander Robinson Movie and TV Reviews to discuss a 1987 film that had portions filmed several years apart from each other, and it shows, starring Kevin Bacon and Sean Astin, directed by Jeff Bleckner. It's Whitewater Summer. But first...
This is a true story. The names have been changed to protect the innocent and the guilty. Mainly, it's the story of...
The Forgotten Filmcast.
We've brought back those good old time flavors, and today they're better than ever. All these delicious treats are waiting for you at the refreshment stand. Delicious fresh popcorn, ice cold cola, tasting candy you know and love. They're all ready for you now, so you won't have to miss any of the feature. Come and get them.
Jim Rex? What's Jim Rex? Would you believe a movie audience guide presented as a public service by this theater's management to help you select your motion picture entertainment? Well, that's what it is. And we urge you to learn these rating symbols and use them as a guide for you and your family. G means suggested for general audiences, all ages. M, suggested for mature audiences, parental discretion advised. R, restricted, persons under 16 not admitted unless accompanied by parent or adult guardian. X, persons under 16 will not be admitted. This seal in advertising indicates that the film was approved under the Motion Picture Code of Self-Regulation.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
At the start of the new moon, I was absolutely positive of three things. First, Radu was a vampire. Second, my one birthday wish was to feel his kiss. And third...
Oh!
Nothing could prepare my friends and I for our semester abroad in Transylvania.
It looks a little different in the brochure.
Seriously?
This semester.
Hey, that vampire looks just like you.
What? Do fat and ugly guys have girlfriends like this?
They have no idea what they're in for.
Yeah. I need a freak.
Ragorza, your computer boyfriend's here.
I need a freak with long, long hair. A super freak.
I had a hunch there was going to be something special about her.
And they're in way over their heads.
Some say vampires walk castle grounds.
Something weird is happening.
Is that true?
Very exciting.
I've got the perfect way to pick up girls.
I tell them I'm a vampire slayer.
One teacher is preparing for battle.
Are you a vampire hunter?
Yeah, baby.
And not every student.
What is this?
Are you ready for some hunting?
We'll make the grade.
Stay away from my girlfriend!
Oh, you are so incredible.
Of the sexiest,
right.
Most outrageous.
Wait a minute. I don't have reflection.
Vampire comedy adventure of the year.
Have a little steak!
College Kids, the other white meat.
Alright, freeze, vampires!
Shoot him! He's the vampire!
No, shoot him! He is the vampire.
Don't know which one is which. Are you a moron?
Transylvania.
And now, on with the show.
Some haul, Alan.
Yeah, well, I really feel one with nature today, you know.
It must be six or seven in there.
I can't even believe that.
How'd you do it?
No big deal. It's really simple. See, they swim through the chute, the trap closes, and they can't get out. Pretty neat, huh? I rigged it all myself.
Neat? No, I don't think that's neat. What do you guys think?
Hey, wait a second. Hey, I caught those.
No, you didn't. Not the right way, you didn't.
Oh, you mean your way?
No! I mean the right way. You know, you're a smart kid, Alan, but you really let me down this time. You let yourself down. So what do you say you clean the fish that Chris and I caught before we leave the island, then we can forget about your little trick?
No!
Well, I could help you.
No. No, this is Alan's job. Come here. Come here, I'll show you. Nothing to it. Right? All you have to do is gut it. There's nothing to it. Now, why don't you clean the rest of these? And we'll finish loading up the canoe.
No! No way!
You'll do it. And you're gonna stay here until it's finished. Let's go, guys.
Okay, our movie this time is Whitewater Summer from 1987. And joining me to discuss this film is Alexander Robinson from Alexander Robinson Movie and TV Reviews. Alexander, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you on the show here. Why don't you take a moment, tell everybody a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Yes, yeah, so hi, everyone. As Todd mentioned, my name is Alexander Robinson. I have a movie review channel on YouTube that he just pointed out, Alexander Robinson Movie and TV Reviews, that turned 10 years old last April.
Oh, awesome. So
it's been going on for over 10 years. My main, if you go to that channel, my main, like, mojo or main, the thing that defines me there is Godzilla and giant monster stuff. So I know Godzilla Minus One is still relatively fresh in people's minds. So if that's your wheelhouse, then you check out the YouTube channel. And I also have another YouTube channel that's not as full time as the movie one, which is focused more on theme park videos, like vlogs, on ride stuff. So if you like that, you can go check out my other channel, Alexander Robinson Travel Channel.
Oh.
Simple as that.
I definitely need to check the other one out. I remember hearing about it, but I haven't explored it. And in the time since we last talked together, we were on another podcast together a few weeks back, and I've made some plans. My wife and I are going to Walt Disney World this summer to celebrate our anniversary. So I haven't been there in, I think, about 14 years. So I know a lot has changed since then, and I'm like trying to get up to speed on like all the things that you need to know, because I know there's like a science to this stuff.
Yeah, especially when it comes to the Disney parks. I myself have only been there once. It was all the way back in 2006, so almost 20 years ago, and it was Epcot. So I've been to Orlando a few other times since, but only to Universal Orlando.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, I went there once to Universal Orlando. I remember I did go to Universal out in California. This is going way back. It was 1985, actually, the summer of 85.
Oh, wow.
And I was there. They were really hyping Back to the Future, which opened like the week before we were there. So, you know, we're going around the streets of Hill Valley there and the clock tower and all that. And I hadn't seen the movie yet. And then, of course, a few weeks later, I got to see the movie and it was like, oh, wow, I was just there. Amazing.
Wow, 1985. So you were there like right before they started transitioning to the theme park stuff, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it was still very much the backlot studio, and that was pretty much what was there. I mean, other than, you know, they had like a stunt show and there was an animal actors show and stuff. I remember the stunt show back then was themed around the A-Team. So they had this guy that made himself look like Mr. T and all that kind of stuff.
Nice. So
yeah, but I mean, that was a lot of fun for me as a young movie fan, you know, getting to see all the stuff around the back lot. I remember they were filming Psycho 3 at the time, so they had all this equipment up around the Bates Motel set. So yeah, that's a great memory for me.
Nice.
Now, you mentioned before Godzilla, and I know there's a lot more to your YouTube videos than just Godzilla, but where we did get to talk previously, like I said, we were on a podcast together a few weeks ago. We were on an episode of Out Now with Aaron and Abe, where we got to talk about Godzilla Minus One, which we all agreed is a great movie. I mean, I think I'm thinking back through the year, I think I have it right now as my number three film out of 2023. It was just an amazing theatrical experience. But I mean, I guess what is it about Godzilla specifically that, you know, piques your interest so much?
I mean, I have I would say the easy answer is that giant radioactive monsters or just giant lizards in general are my kryptonite. Like I'll see anything involving like a giant dinosaur, giant reptilian monster, no matter how bad it ends up being. And I'll just go out and see it. But I think Minus One definitely like emphasized why Godzilla appeals so much to me, is that it's certainly a franchise that's definitely had a lot of identities, but at its core is like a movie about something that, or a franchise about something that's very, very like personal to the history of Japan, and at points where they stand in the world.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. One of the things that came out in that conversation we had was that, I mean, it's a great movie, even if Godzilla wasn't in it. And yeah, that's saying a lot. So, well, when it comes to those giant monsters, then, I mean, you know, there's a lot beyond Godzilla. I mean, what is your favorite? I mean, even, I mean, there's tons of Godzilla movies. There's lots of other Toho movies, lots of other giant monster movies. What are among your favorites?
I mean, if we're going to put the Godzilla franchise aside, or at least the main movies, the 90s Gamera trilogy is another one that really works for me.
Mm-hmm.
Those movies are incredible. The original Mothra from 1961.
Probably one of my favorite kaiju movies right there.
Yeah, Mothra is great. The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. It's a very simple movie, not as like in-depth as, not as deep as like the best Godzilla movies, but still an important one nonetheless.
Mm-hmm.
And then a big guilty pleasure of mine is the Giant Claw.
Oh, well, absolutely. Yeah.
Like, I remember seeing that. I showed that movie to my dad for the first time years ago. And like the scene where the Giant Claw was about to pop up, he was about to say something to me. And as soon as the bird showed up, his brain froze. Like he forgot what he was going to say just because he was so flabbergasted at how bad the Giant Claw looked.
It is probably one of the cheesiest looking giant monsters in all of movies, but yeah, very memorable. There's once you see the Giant Claw, there's no way to forget it.
Yeah, and the thing is, the movie probably would never have been remembered as well as it is if it wasn't for that puppet.
Mm-hmm.
Like, had they done it with a company with more money, or had they done it with stop motion, it would have just blended in with the crowd and not gotten the reputation that it has.
One of the giant monster movies that always jumps out for me, and it's one that we actually covered on this podcast many years ago. I mean, going back 10 years ago, I think it was within the first 15 or so episodes that we did. We did an episode on War of the Gargantuas, which very hard to find a copy of back 10 years ago. It's a little bit more available now, but I remember I think I caught up with it on Netflix at the time, when Netflix actually bothered to show old movies. And War of the Gargantuas is just amazing. One of the things I just really enjoy about it is just there's just a more intensity to the monster action, I think, because it's not guys in bulky rubber suits that they can barely move in. I mean, the actors that are playing the gargantuas can really get physical and move around a lot, and the action is just phenomenal.
Yeah, and it's one of the few times where the Toho movies, like, you could actually see the suit actors' eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, not only are they more visible, and then also it depends on which version of that movie you're watching. I guess maybe not, because they're both brothers. The monsters are supposed to be brothers, Sanda and Gaira. Mm-hmm. And there's that one moment where Sanda realizes that Gaira's been eating people. And it's like that. It's that slow build up to where it's like, you are an embarrassment, Gaira. I'm going to smack you with this tree, and then we're just going to fight till the death.
Yeah, it's a great flick. And I will say, too, I finally got to catch up last year with the movie that came before it, because technically it's a sequel to Frankenstein Conquers the World, and I really enjoyed that one as well.
Depending on which version you watch.
All right, well, let's get on to this movie we have today. It has absolutely nothing to do with giant monsters, I guess, unless you count Kevin Bacon in that category, but that'd be a stretch. this is called Whitewater Summer, released in 1987. It's directed by a guy named Jeff Blechner. He began as a theater director, first off-Broadway and then Broadway, and then eventually made his way into television, directing a lot of episodes of famous shows of the 70s and 80s. He did episodes on stuff like Welcome Back, Cotter, Dynasty, Hill Street Blues, Remington Steel, a bunch of the shows that I grew up with. Also did a number of TV movies and miniseries, probably a couple of the most famous ones. He did the remake of Rear Window that starred Christopher Reeve, one of his last roles.
Really?
And then he also did the miniseries The Beach Boys and American Family, which I guess was pretty popular as well. But when it comes to theatrical films, This is really it. And this didn't get much of a release. Now, one of the other behind the scenes credits we should also mention here is the cinematography, which is by John Alcott, who frequently worked with none other than Stanley Kubrick. He worked with Kubrick on 2001: A Space Odyssey, A Clockwork Orange, Barry Lyndon, and The Shining. So this guy's no slouch, but he unfortunately passed away shortly before this film was released. And so his credit at the beginning of the film states that the film is dedicated to him. It's kind of unusual to see that in the opening credits like that. Anyway, this film, it centers on a young teenager, kind of a rich kid from New York. His name is Alan, played by Sean Astin. And he's a bit of a sheltered, brainy kid, but his parents are anxious for him to, let's say, man up a bit. So they send him out west for this 6-week trip into the wilderness. It's kind of a survival trip. And the guy that's leading it is this kind of cocky guy named Vic, played by Kevin Bacon. There's also three other teenage boys on this trip, a guy named Mitch, played by Jonathan Ward, a guy named George, played by Casey Martell, and Chris, played by Matt Adler, who I got to point out, this is his second appearance on this podcast in the last few months because he was the star of the surfing film North Shore, which we talked about last fall. Now, Alan is not entirely excited about this trip. And to be honest, he's a bit scared about certain aspects of it. And I can't say I blame him. I would be too. The group is going to be spending long periods of time hiking across the wilderness, camping out in the wild, and then eventually scaling the side of a mountain. And Alan seems to be the one member of this group who is always kind of lagging a bit behind, just doesn't quite seem to be up to the challenge the way that some of the other ones are. Meanwhile, the guide, Vic, keeps kind of pushing him and the other boys, to try and get them to do more, go farther, etc. Basically, this is a guy who doesn't accept no for an answer. And so even when Alan is terrified to, cross the most dangerous-looking rope bridge that you've ever seen in your life, he doesn't really have a whole lot of sympathy. It's just like, well, do it, And so, yeah, it's no fun for Alan. Things keep on getting harder and harder for him, and Vic, meanwhile, just seems to get more and more sadistic in his treatment of the fearful teen. Eventually, though, the tables are turned, and Vic finds himself in a situation where he must depend on Alan and the other boys for survival. Now, this film, it was shot in 1985, right at the time when Sean Astin was hitting it big with The Goonies, but it didn't get released until 2 years later, and that really shows, as there's some parts of this film that kind of make the passage of time obvious. I'm sure we'll talk more about that in a bit, but I'm going to go ahead and let Alexander get us started here. Give us a few of your thoughts on Whitewater Summer.
Okay, so I've never heard of this movie. And out of the list you sent me of movies for us to talk about, this one piqued my interest the most just because when I read the plot description, I thought I'd live through this. So that's what I initially said when I read the plot description, because years ago I had a 10-day backpacking trek in one of my last years of high school. And then watching, when the movie starts, I thought, oh, wow, this is exactly like my trip, almost down to like certain people who weren't really up to it and didn't want to do this. And then as the movie went on, I thought, no, this is not at all like my trip. This is more sadistic, mean-spirited, and it's sort of like a every last man for himself kind of movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad to hear that you didn't end up having quite as difficult a situation with whatever adults were leading you out into the wild. And that's kind of the big thing that sticks out here is you look at this and go, man, this guy Vic is like a lawsuit waiting to happen here because he doesn't have a whole lot of sympathy for these kids as he's challenging them with stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I will say there was something like similar that happened. Not similar, but there was a big goof up in our trip And that's all I'll say. I don't want to get into too many details about it, but
I'm sure the statute of limitations has worn out for whatever.
Yeah.
I guess for me, I knew about this movie. I think I'd seen bits and pieces of it maybe on cable TV back in the day, just kind of flipping the dial and stuff. But it's not something that I ever saw all the way through. I just have a vague memory of, like, Kevin Bacon out in the wild. Though maybe I'm even confusing that with The River Wild. I don't know. But, I mean, the premise did interest me a bit. I think, you know, I'm not really an outdoorsman type of guy, but I do enjoy going out and hiking from time to time. I live in Colorado, and you know, going out hitting a trail or something like that is something my family and I do enjoy doing. We definitely don't do anything as strenuous as this. I would not be up to it at all. But I don't know, just the idea of going out there and all that. And, you know, the setting, it does kind of look like it could be Colorado. I don't think they actually say where they are in this, but my interest was piqued with that. I don't think it's a, you know, like a stellar movie by any stretch of the imagination, but there were certainly things that kept me engaged in it. I was sitting there really getting drawn into what was going on, and the next thing I realized, the film was kind of wrapping up, and I was like, oh, I didn't find myself checking my phone or anything during this movie. So that at least was working for it.
Yeah, it definitely was a short movie, which I mean, I don't think this movie is like god awful or anything, because there's certainly scenes that, because I had a similar experience, I just went, I found myself more invested, like I was back in those shoes. And Kevin Bacon's character alone just made me like want to keep watching the movie just to see what they're going to do with him, and them as in like the kids that he brings along with them, because he does some stuff in this movie that I'm just like, I'm amazed that you haven't died sooner.
Well, yeah. And I mean, there are several moments in this film where you're kind of watching it and going, well, that sure looks like it's actually Kevin Bacon doing that. And that looks like it's Sean Astin, you know? So I don't know if it was them or if they just really had some good looking stunt doubles there, but they convinced me. And yeah, I think that Kevin Bacon is probably kind of the big draw of this film. I thought it was kind of unusual for him when I thought about his career, because again, thinking about the fact that even though this was released in 87, it was filmed in 85. I mean, here he's playing a real jerk character. And 85 is coming right after he really started to hit it big. He had Footloose in 1984, which was a huge hit in a big year of movies. I mean, there's so many huge movies in 1984, and Footloose was among the top 10. So that's where people really started to take notice of Kevin Bacon. And here, right after that, he takes this project where he plays just an absolute jerk. And I even though he's very good in it, you know, it's not the type of movie that, you know, makes the audience really want to root for you in other things, because, yeah, that was that jerk that bullied Sean Astin around.
Yeah, and I mean, I feel like that's being nice, because he, like, he's not just a jerk, he's just flat out sadistic. And there was a part of me that was wondering, is there going to be a plot twist where we find out that he's actually this, like, serial killer in disguise as a suave Kevin Bacon? Because there's I don't know if you caught this, but early on in the movie, he's wearing a sweater that looks like the same sweater Mrs. Voorhees wears in Friday the 13th.
Oh, I didn't even catch on to that.
Which Kevin Bacon was in.
Exactly, yeah. Well, yeah, and I mean, just the way he presents himself through this whole thing, you know, it's one of those cases where I like, you know, he puts on a certain front for some people, but then we see his true colors come out when he's out there with these kids. I mean, that opening sequence of the film is where, you know, he's basically come to New York. He's there doing the sales pitch, talking with Sean Astin's parents, trying to get them to send their boy off on this trip. He's very much coming across as this just got it all together, and it's all safe for the kids, and everything's by the book, and you know, he'll be perfectly fine. And then as soon as they get out there in the wild, it's just, well, you got a problem, figure it out, kid, or you're gonna die.
Yeah, it's like, hey, I got a better idea, help me.
Well, yeah, and that's one of the weird things about it is that it seems like there's no real training that goes on with this. He basically just, you know, gets the kids out there in the wild and then they go at it. There's no moments where they're like, okay, well, here's how you want to set up your tent. Here's the way you put on your backpack. Here, you know, make sure that your shoes are in good condition. You know, here's, I mean, and especially when it comes to the rock climbing, there's this whole rock climbing sequence. You know, as they get kind of the midpoint of the film. And I'm thinking, did they train at all for this? How does Sean Astin from New York, you know, living in an apartment overlooking Central Park or whatever, how does he know how to rock climb?
I know. But even when their, like, survival instincts kick in, Vic still scolds them, especially for Alan. Like, there's that moment when they're catching fish and Alan comes up with a fish trap to catch fish a little more easier. And I'm like, that's inventive.
Yeah.
Like you're really taking your survival instincts from like the big city and putting them to practical use. And then Vic just takes all the fish and throws them back in the lake. And goes, do it correctly. Clean all these fish. I'm going to leave you on this island. And then overnight we'll pick you up.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Dude, come on.
No, absolutely. I mean, I was thinking that was the moment that was going to maybe turn things around and Vic was going to realize, oh, this kid Alan's got some smarts. He's got some good instincts. He can make it work out here in the wild. But no, he gets upset because he was successful at doing something, but he didn't do it the way that he would have done it. And I'm thinking, what a big ego this guy has. It's not really about learning how to survive. It's about learning how to survive his way. And,
yeah. You
know, that's just not the way it works.
God forbid they made this movie in caveman times, because there would be some caveman that has a new way of creating fire, and Vic just goes, no, you have to do it this way.
Mm-hmm.
The results were shown. Just as long as the results were done, I don't think it matters how.
Well, they hit on a lot of different kind of challenges as they go through this journey. And I guess I'll just bump it to you first. You know, what are maybe some of the standout moments here as they make their way, you know, across the wild, the bridge, the rocks, all that stuff? What worked for you?
There were a couple. I think the main one that sticks out to me was that bridge, because it's not like the standard Temple of Doom bridge that we know.
This makes the Temple of Doom bridge look like an architectural wonder. It's ridiculous how rickety this thing is.
Not just rickety, but it's like one plank on top of each other. And you're just
like 5 inches wide. Yeah.
Yeah. And who knows how tall, like how deep that canyon is. It's like, this is, I don't know, it's such a bizarre moment. And the fact that Alan has to go back afterwards get the, what's it called, the stuff, what do you call it, the stuff that...
The tent poles, yeah.
Thank you. They have to go back to get them. I'm like, dude, Vic, you're the adult. Why don't you go back and do it? You've done this several times before. Or better yet, why don't you just sleep outside? Huh?
Yeah. Well, and not to mention the fact that he sends him back for that, and he's already, you know, had to you know, scoot his way across that bridge once. Now he's going to have to do it again and then back again, and it's getting dark, and I don't know how, he said it's like a half a mile walk to get to the bridge. So I'm thinking, I mean, what happens if it gets completely dark while he's out there doing this? He can't see where he's stepping and all this stuff. I mean, it's just, again, it's just ridiculous and such a contrast from what Vic is pitching in the opening part of the film. I'm thinking if the parents had seen this on the brochure, they never would have let the kid go.
Yeah, that's something I want to know. It's like, is this guy actually legit? Like, mm-hmm. is he with some sort of company that's like, yeah, this guy's trustworthy? You'll let your kids go out backpacking with him.
I mean, I agree. I think that was a good sequence. And again, one where you're watching and going, well, I mean, it sure looks that like it's the actual people doing it. And that it really looks like that bridge is 200 feet above the little stream that it's over and all that stuff. I mean, it worked for me as well. I thought the rock climbing sequence was also pretty good. And again, another example of just how this character that Kevin Bacon plays just pushes things too far and does these things that it's just like, no, why on earth would you do that to another human being, let alone some 14-year-old kid?
Exactly.
I mean, it's just, I don't know. I mean, the rock climbing thing, it's never something that I have ever put into my mind that I would do. I have no desire to do that. It seems way too dangerous. And they're swinging across the string thing, trying to get from one side to another. And Sean Astin can't do it. And Kevin Bacon just leaves him hanging there and says, figure it out, kid. They walk away.
Yeah. I mean, I've done rock climbing in my life, but that's what it was. It was rock climbing. I wasn't elevated up in the mountains doing this kind of stuff. Like, it is, I don't know. Like, this movie is just a giant, like, psychological torture machine for these kids, especially that moment where Vic supposedly just disappears and these kids have to survive a stormy, rainy night.
Yeah, he's gone for like 2 days. Well, I like what you were saying about it being like this kind of psychological thriller in some ways for these kids. I mean, it's not presented in that kind of a dark way like some other films are. But, I mean, they definitely could have taken this in a darker direction because, yeah, absolutely. The things that Vic is doing to these youngsters, you know, could just really be, a difficult and scary experience. They could have made this a lot more intimidating than they do in the screen. I mean, in general, they're trying to make this, I think, kind of a light 80s teen type of a film. But honestly, you know, the film is much more serious than your average 80s teen movie is.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely is, but it's not, I'd say it's like sort of a middle ground between like some of the more goofier teen movies you get back then and the, well, not as good as the movies from John Hughes, where uh-huh. they're definitely, I mean, it's, you can't really compare this to John Hughes at all.
No.
But it's definitely like the middle ground between those types of subgenres.
I think, though, you can see where the filmmakers, the producers were maybe trying to, I don't know, get into that maybe John Hughes mold a little bit. And I think that is mainly kind of an afterthought in those kind of narration segments that we have in this film. And that's where I was saying before that, you know, the majority of this film was shot in 1985, right after Sean Astin is coming off the Goonies, wasn't released until 87. Well, in that 2-year time span, they decided they were going to add these narration segments where we have these shots of Sean Astin and he's in what looks like the forest and he's kind of given this commentary on this story that he's telling. And I mean, clearly Sean Astin has gotten older during this time. I mean, you look a lot different when you're a 14-year-old boy than when you're a 16-year-old boy. And it shows in these segments because Sean Astin looks like a completely different person in those narration moments. And I think that they, you know, kind of some of the dialogue they give him in those scenes, it's meant to be a little bit more light, a little bit more humorous. He's, you know, like I said, wearing this Hawaiian shirt and such. I almost feel like they're trying to turn him into this Ferris Bueller type of a character. And it doesn't really work.
No. And the fact that the poster makes him look like that type of character, like just completely misleads the audience. Like you're looking at that poster and you're thinking, yeah, Sean Astin's going to be like Ferris Bueller, since this did come out a year after Ferris Bueller's Day Off. But
right.
No, that's not the case at all. I figured that's what happened because I really did think, wow, did Sean Astin just age 2 years in the year they made this movie? And also, does it feel like those scenes were directed by somebody else?
They could very well have been. I mean, they could have been anybody. There's really not a lot of style or flair to what's going on in those scenes. I mean, I got to say, I think that even though this isn't like, you know, some kind of work of an auteur or anything like that, I got to give some credit to the director, the cinematographer and such, that they do make the film look pretty good. You know, some of the outdoor photography, the mountain stuff, all that, you know, it looks good. There's nothing creative at all about the narration moments. And in fact, the narration moments are very cheesy. I mean, there's these bits that they do in there to try and make things funny where, like, you know, he's talking about the rope bridge and trying to say how dangerous it was. And he's got this little mock-up of his own rope bridge, and he does this thing with an egg, and he drops the egg, and, you know, it's like, dude, we don't need that to know that that bridge was dangerous. We can see that shot. It looks very dangerous.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, the narration moments feel like a completely different movie.
100%. Although I got to say, in Sean Astin's defense, considering that this movie technically came out in 1987, it is better than the movie that his brother had the same year.
Oh, which I'm losing it. What movie are we talking about?
Garbage Pail Kids.
Oh, Mackenzie Astin. Yes. No, that is an awful movie. I wholeheartedly admit that. Well, I guess in general, though, I mean, besides the narration moments here, how do you think our leading man, the young Sean Astin, does in this film? I mean, it's his first film walking across vast distances. Good training for the Lord of the Rings, I guess. But other than that, how does he do?
He's fine. Like I think he handles the like nerdy indoor kid style fine. And one thing I do appreciate is that the other kids, like they start out as these typical bullies, but over time, like they start to really sympathize with Alan, considering all the scenarios that Vic puts him through.
Mm-hmm.
So I do appreciate that they don't stay bullies throughout the entire movie and just make his life absolute torture during this trip.
It kind of takes, you know, more incidents than I would have thought for them to start to turn around, though. I mean, because the rope bridge, you know, I thought that would have been the breaking point. But it's not until we get to the rope climbing incident that they really start to turn around and being like, hey, Vic, you could have killed the guy there. What are you doing? So, yeah, I was a little frustrated, though, that there weren't, I guess, there wasn't more development with those other teenage characters that are along the journey. We really don't get to know anything about who they are, where they're from, what their background is. They're just kind of there and button heads with Sean Astin for the earlier parts of the film. I thought it would have been good to have them, you know, have a bit more bonding experiences. Like you said, there's some promise of that when they have that moment where Vic leaves them alone for a couple of nights. They have to work together. That's good. There's a weird bonding moment for them, which has to do with like peeing, you know, seeing who can pee on a rock or something like that. But we won't get into that too much. But I thought there was just kind of a lack of character development for these other supporting characters. And it was a bit frustrating because some of these guys, though they weren't big names at the time, these are guys that did show up in a number of other 80s teen movies. I mean, like I talked about, Matt Adler, he was in North Shore. He was in Teen Wolf. He's in a segment of Amazon Women on the Moon. Casey Martell, he was one of the friends of Elliot's older brother in E.T. He was the guy with the headphones. And, you know, so these guys, you know, they're capable of more, but they're not given a whole lot to do.
Yeah. And speaking of E.T., let's not forget that Jonathan Ward was in Mac and Me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
which I guess is an iconic 80s movie in its own way.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, really, all the other characters kind of get overshadowed by Kevin Bacon here. I mean, he has such a presence in this film. And again, just a character that it's a lot of fun to hate in this movie, I guess, is the thing. I don't know if that's the type of thing that actors want to shoot for, but in this case, he really sells it.
Oh, yeah. I think like any actor getting a chance to like do a really good job at playing somebody you despise, I feel like there needs to be more of an understanding that, like, no, you hate the character for doing this, not the actor. Because the actor is doing a really good job at making you hate the person they're playing.
Mm-hmm.
Although I do have to say, I feel like the way the movie ends with us trying to feel sort of sympathy for him was not really earned, in my opinion, at least.
I wanted to talk about that last act here because, yeah, it is kind of an attempt to get you to feel for Vic a little bit here. I mean, we don't shy away from spoilers on this podcast. We talk about very old movies, so we'll give some stuff away here. But I will say I kind of saw what ultimately happens, you know, to kind of launch into that third act. I saw that coming a mile away. I was like, with all the stuff that Kevin Bacon is putting these guys through, and especially Sean Astin's character, something is going to happen to him. He's going to get injured in some way, and he's going to have to depend on Astin to save him. I was like, it's just, it had to happen that way.
It had to happen. I just don't buy into the fact that they would be like 100% buddies afterwards.
Well, yeah. I mean, we actually don't get to see much of them after the ultimate, the day is saved, so to speak. There still seems to be a little bit of tension between them when they're kind of going through the little, you know, canoe run down the rapids and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, you do kind of get the impression that, that all is good in the end. I would have liked to have a little bit of a, I don't know, a heart to heart moment. If you're going to try and, you know, get it to where everybody's nicey-nicey, I at least give some moment where Sean Astin gets to go like, man, you really hurt me, I, you know, and all that, but I'm gonna forgive you, man, you know, I'm a bigger guy than you are.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that would have helped. And also, I feel like the movie just cuts off too quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, there is that scene that was clearly filmed years later where they needed to do, like, a proper wrap up, and I say that in quote fingers, because I feel like the way this movie really ends is that Vic is taken to ER, Alan's parents hear about the experience, Vic gets fired from whatever, like, did they even establish that he's like part of a group or whatever?
No, I mean, it just seems like he's just some guy.
Okay, so like, let's just say in headcanon that he's hired by some like outdoor recreational group. Vic gets fired from his job. That, I feel like that's the way this movie has to end.
Right. I will say, you kind of do get, I don't know, I feel guilty saying it, but you know, a little bit of satisfaction, kind of that yeah moment, just when Vic does have his accident, so to speak, which I don't know if we can even really call it an accident, because it's caused because one of the other kids like chucks a rock at him and he takes a tumble down the hill.
Chucks a rock at his head.
Yeah.
Like, it's a miracle that he survived that, but
it is. And plus, I mean, it's a pretty gruesome too. I was a little surprised for a PG-13 80s teen film that, you know, when we kind of see what happens to him. I mean, we see the broken leg with the bone bulging out and all that stuff. There's a lot of blood. It's not the family friendly hour.
No, certainly not. I mean, I feel like PG-13 in the 80s could get away with a lot.
Yeah, well, where they get away with it most in this is the language. That was the thing that mainly kind of put it to a PG-13 level. But then they did have that moment of gore, if you want to call it that, that kind of pushed it over the edge.
Yeah,
I will say I liked the I did like the whole kind of escape down the rapids. That's kind of the centerpiece of the movie's finale. Again, you know, I thought they did a good job of making it look dangerous and selling me that it was actually Sean Astin and Kevin Bacon in the boat. And, you know, the tumble they take down that waterfall is pretty wild.
Oh, yeah. Like, yeah, I'm just thinking, well, Vic is dead.
Yeah, I thought the other leg's broke now, too. So
the other leg's broken, or the broken leg is just gone.
It's off. Yeah.
Like, it's floating in the river. Like, he comes out of the water and he looks like Bo Derek from Orca.
Yeah. Well, before we wrap things up, this, I wanted to throw out one other thing about the film that was very 80s to me, and it didn't particularly work well here, but it was the soundtrack, which I kind of wonder if is also one of the things that was added kind of late in the process, you know, as they were trying to say, oh, well, what do we need to do to lighten this movie up a bit? Let's add these narration things with Sean Astin. Let's also add a bunch of pop songs. And it pains me to say this because I love 80s soundtracks. That is my thing. I mean, I grew up in the 80s. When I go to the used record store, that's where I go. I go to the soundtrack section. I'm looking for old vinyl of 80s movie soundtracks. And this movie, the songs just really get in the way. They are bombastic. They are overbearing. They almost drown out some of what's going on screen at various moments. And there's a few by some big artists. I mean, they've got some songs in here by Journey. They've got some Bruce Hornsby stuff. There's also a bunch of stuff by folks you never heard of before. But, I mean, I get that in the 80s, we were, you know, the movie studios were not just wanting a hit movie. They were also wanting a hit soundtrack. But this is one of the few cases where I really was just not appreciating the soundtrack at all because I just thought it was getting in the way.
Yeah, it didn't belong. It just felt like we mentioned, it's trying to give sort of a Ferris Bueller's feeling. It's like the type of movie that this is supposed to be and what Vic puts all these kids through can't have these kinds of songs playing in the background.
Yeah, like I said, I think it was a really attempt to kind of lighten things up because a lot of the film was kind of serious and darker. They just didn't work. Well, before we take it to the break here, any final thoughts you have on this one?
It certainly made me appreciate my 10-day backpacking trip a lot more because I didn't have to go through any of this. It's an okay movie. Like it's something that maybe like you can have on, playing in the background. It's not offensive or anything, but it is kind of a mess.
I agree that it's kind of a mess. I found it to be kind of an enjoyable mess, I guess would be a good way to describe it, because it did definitely have me engaged. You know, I mean, it's rare for me to run across an 80s movie that's just not in my mind already. You know, I just really didn't have much background on this film. Like I said, maybe a scene here or there on HBO when I was a teenager. But otherwise, this is one that was just completely off the radar. I enjoyed it on a certain level, but I agree that, you know, there are problems with it that do kind of stand out like a sore thumb. And just the challenges that it looks like they had having shot this film so long before they released it and then trying to kind of cobble it together into something that it wasn't meant to be. It does hinder things a bit, but it doesn't mean that the film's not enjoyable on a certain level. All right, well, let's take a quick break here. We'll hear from another one of our podcasting friends, and then we'll be back with our movie recommendations here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
Hey, Jay, can I ask you a question?
Sure, Mark. Far away.
How come Carter's always sliding around in Deep Blue Sea?
Wow.
And how come Preacher has a bird in the kitchen?
I think...
Should Janice have won an Oscar for all that exposition?
Yeah, I mean...
Who do the sharks hate the most? How far did Jim travel underwater? Why do they keep calling Brenda Tower?
Mark, please, we've already covered all of these topics and many, many more on Deep Blue Sea, the podcast.
You mean the podcast where we analyze Rennie Harlan's 1999 masterpiece, Deep Blue Sea, chapter by chapter?
Exactly! Find it everywhere podcasts can be found.
Hi, everybody, this is Todd, just here to remind you that you can help support the Forgotten Filmcast through Patreon. For just a few bucks a month, you can support this show and earn access to some bonus features, including a bunch of the older episodes of the show that are no longer available on the main podcast feed. So visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more, and we thank you for your support.
We are like the Maury Povich of podcasts. People come to this show because it's a train wreck.
I'm giving this podcast 3 stars. The coast keeps yelling at me.
The people have clearly spoken. Check out Whatever with Jason Soto on Anchor, Apple, Google, wherever you get awesome podcasts, or you can go to the home location at rabbitholepodcast.com. Second thing, yes, I want to talk about is I want to talk about urination. I want to talk about peeing specifically.
See what happens when Jason throws out the segments. This is what we get instead.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're happy to announce that we've installed Burns-O-Matic in-car heaters for your comfort and pleasure. When you receive your heater, you'll find it very easy to place in your car. Just roll down your front window and rest the heater's bracket on the window with the cylinder on the outside of the car. Roll up your window securely as far as it will go to hold the heater firmly in position. For maximum results, tilt the face of the heater towards the windshield and sit back and enjoy the show in healthful comfort. With these modern, safe, efficient in-car heaters, this drive-in theater will now remain open all year round. If you have any further questions about your Burns-O-Matic in-car heater, please contact one of our theater attendants. And remember, this drive-in theater will now remain open all year round, regardless of the weather.
Okay, welcome back. It's time for our movie recommendations. This is the part of the show where each of us gets to talk about another movie that we've enjoyed that we want to just let everybody else know about. It might be a forgotten film. It might be an old classic. It might be something new in theaters or maybe something on streaming. It could be anything. So, Alexander, what is your recommendation?
So, my recommendation, kind of going back to earlier in the show, we were talking about Godzilla, maybe not in the same, like, actual genre, but it's from the same director of the original. I'm going to go with Ishiro Honda's The H-Man from 1958.
Ooh, I don't know this one.
So The H-Man is, the plot basically involves this man that has been exposed to nuclear radiation on a ship that it's kind of mirroring the Lucky Dragon number 5 incident that inspired the original Godzilla. And it basically plays out more like a film noir horror movie. It's not really big on special effects, but it has this creepy noir style to it. It's got some recognizable actors from a lot of the Godzilla films, like Akihito Hirata, Kenji Sahara. It's a really cool movie. It's one of Ishiro Honda's like lesser known films. I feel like since he's so well known for Godzilla, Rodan, Mothra, and all the sequels, it's one that's certainly worth checking out. I'm not exactly sure where you can find it. Like, I know I'm not sure how you can find it on DVD. It is on Tubi. It's on Tubi, Vudu, and Amazon Prime.
Oh, excellent. I keep on saying I think Tubi is the best streaming service out there right now, especially when it comes to the type of films we talk about on this show. They just are always pulling things out there that you can't find anyplace else, or that, you know, that got stuck on VHS and never made it to DVD or whatever. Just I continue to love Tubi. So once again, they come through here. This is one, like I said, I'd never heard of it before. I mean, you know, with Ishiro Honda, I mean, the brain just automatically goes to giant monsters. And I know he did other things. I mean, he's a well-regarded director. I mean, when people always talk about the big influential Japanese directors, the two names that always come out first are Akira Kurosawa and Ishiro Honda. And I know it's not just because of Godzilla movies for Honda, but I admit I have not seen any of his stuff outside of the realm of giant monsters.
No, yeah, The H-Man is certainly one that's worth checking out. I think that movie doesn't get enough credit.
Excellent. Well, I will definitely be putting that on my list. Well, for my recommendation, I was kind of thinking about how the movie we talked about, Whitewater Summer, had this big delay between when it was filmed and when it was released, and how it went through some changes over time, and you know, that included adding some narration and all this stuff. And it got me thinking of another film that went through some similar stuff that I actually had on today in the background while I was doing some other things. And I thought, yeah, let's talk about this one because I don't think this movie gets enough love. It's actually a Disney animated film. It started as something completely different. It was going to be a musical, kind of epic in scale. And then they twisted it all around, changed things, got rid of the songs, and we got The Emperor's New Groove, which I have always thought is a wonderful film, but is very different than anything else the studio ever did. I mean, basically, I really can't think of another Disney animated film that is just a straight up comedy. This is an irreverent buddy road comedy. And I think it's pretty darn hilarious. The voice cast is great. I mean, you've got David Spade, John Goodman, Eartha Kitt, and Patrick Warburton doing the bulk of things here. And all of them are great and just perfectly suited to their roles. Patrick Warburton's the one that steals the show, though, is Kronk.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, the tone of the film is very goofy, but it works. And I think one of the things that really works for me is that a lot of the humor is aimed squarely at the adults in the audience, which I love kids movies. I love Disney movies. I don't have a problem when things are aimed at kids, but I always appreciate when there's stuff in these animated films for the kids, and then there's also stuff there for the adults. And this has a lot of great laugh-out-loud moments that go right over the kids' heads. It's a film that has a great look to it, a lot of unique designs when it comes to like the backgrounds and the costumes. The character designs are wonderfully creative. I mean, like, I haven't seen Wish yet, but I've seen the trailers. And when I look at the character designs for Wish and I look at the character designs for The Emperor's New Groove, I say, what happened? Look at these unique character designs in The Emperor's New Groove and then this flat, very boring looking stuff I've seen in the trailers for Wish. I like this era of Disney better. But anyway, this film, as I said before, it went through a lot of changes. You know, it was originally going to be this musical. Sting was doing the songs, and then it got completely reworked. They got rid of Sting's songs and all that stuff. And, you know, I know that was kind of, you know, controversial and stuff, but, you know, I don't know what that film would have turned out like, but what we got, I think they made the right choice. I really like this one a lot. So I don't think it gets the love that other films of this era do because it, you know, it's not like The Little Mermaid or Aladdin or whatever, but I laugh like an idiot every time I watch this movie. So I think it's a lot of fun.
Oh yeah. I agree. I used to watch this movie a lot when it like first came out, but then I hadn't seen it in, I rewatched it for the first time in about 20 years, in 2021, because on my YouTube channel, I was reviewing every single Disney animated movie that I hadn't reviewed at that point. And I truly forgot how, like, I didn't really get an understanding of how funny this movie was until I became a lot older, once I hit my 30s. And yeah, I think this movie is great. I feel like this particular era of Disney has gotten a lot more appreciation from my generation. Like, there's certain movies like Atlantis and Treasure Planet that didn't do well when they came out, but they've gotten a resurgence amongst my generation in terms of being, yeah, this movie's not that bad.
Yeah, well, I think Atlantis has a lot of creativity to it as well. It's one I've been meaning to revisit here soon. And Treasure Planet, I only saw it the one time. And, you know, like a lot of people, was kind of underwhelmed. But like my kids, they swear by that movie. They're like, Dad, you got to watch Treasure Planet again. It's good. And I was like, all right, we'll see.
Yeah, I honestly, I'm not a huge fan of Treasure Planet. Like my brother is. Like he saw it for the first time not too long ago, and it was like, man, this movie's really good. And I'm like, it's all right. I'm more of an Atlantis guy.
Well, Alexander, I want to thank you for being on the show. Before I let you go here, please remind everybody of where they can find you and all your projects that you're working on out there.
Yes. Yeah, so my main source is my movie review channel, Alexander Robinson Movie and TV Reviews. One thing I'm doing all year on that channel, I'm doing a series of double feature retro reviews. Basically, every month I'll take two movies that are thematically linked to each other, whether by like director, genre, creator, theme, and just review them every other week. So just yesterday, actually, I put up my review for Alfred Hitchcock's Rear Window. And then in 2 weeks, I'll be doing a review for Alfred Hitchcock's Rebecca, which I've never seen before. And then it's going to be a random series of like double feature reviews every month with a completely different theme until the end of the year. So that's what I'm mainly working on my movie review channel. And again, if you enjoy theme park videos, vlogs, that kind of stuff, you can check out my other channel, Alexander Robinson Travel Channel, which doesn't get updated as often, but I feel like having those videos a little more spread out makes it a little more special for me.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, thanks again for being on the show, and I'll be back to close things here in just a moment here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Well, everybody. everybody, that brings us to the end of episode 207. Thank you for listening. Of course, you can find other reviews of Forgotten Films over at the Forgotten Films blog. That's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. Please follow me on Twitter at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And you can like Forgotten Films at Facebook. Of course, we always welcome your questions, comments, and feedback about the show. So feel free to email us at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And don't forget about the Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast. Go there and learn about how you can help support this show. I've also been on some other podcasts recently that I would encourage you to check out. I've been on several episodes of the Lambcast recently. One recent one where we talked about some of the new releases out there, Mean Girls and The Beekeeper. So be sure to check that out through your favorite podcatcher. Thanks as always for listening to this show. And of course, we'll be back real soon with a brand new episode. Take care.
Nobody really great ever slept in dirt. You ever see a picture of Da Vinci pitching a tent? No.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.